No, please remove it. Thank you. Thank you for asking and being careful.
May it please the court, Mr. Durbin. I'd like to address two questions to start off with. Question one, what significance, if any, is the government's argument that possession with intent to distribute is a continuing offense? Question two, can the Supreme Court's statement in Rosemond, I'm not sure I'm saying it right, the United States, that appears to hold that an aider and abettor need only abet one element, how does that square with the cases that I've cited in the brief that appear to hold that an aider and abettor must aid and abet all the elements? Government points out that possession with intent is a continuing offense, and for purposes of venue and statute of limitations, it is. Let's just assume it is in this case. If so, possession with intent to distribute begins when the defendant has the power and intention to exercise control of the controlled substance, and it ends when his possession is interrupted by a complete dispossession. That's United States v. Roe, 919 F3rd 752. And that means in this case, Mr. Garcia, the principal, his offense, at least for sure, began when he came into possession, and it ended when the officers took his methamphetamine away from him at the Road Ranger in Odessa. The only evidence that we have in the record as to what happened between Mr. Cabello and Mr. Garcia prior to 10:39 on the night of June 9th, 2020 is what came from the lips of Mr. Cabello. They'd been apparently at Mr. Cabello's house in Fort Stockton earlier in the day. Mr. Garcia allowed Mr. Garcia used Mr. Cabello's phone. Mr. Cabello ran errands. They left Fort Stockton about 4, arrived in Odessa about 6:22. They stopped at the apartment of some oil field worker. Mr. Cabello stayed in the truck. Mr. Garcia got out and got a bag. Then they went to Jorge's house. Mr. Garcia told Mr. Cabello was Mr. Garcia's cousin. He was just going to drop him off there and leave him there for the night. So they went there. Mr. Cabello stays in the truck. Mr. Garcia goes to the door and talks to Jorge. Mr. Garcia comes back, says, we want to borrow your truck so Jorge can move in RV. Cabello says, no, you can't do that. They go to the airport and they rent a vehicle so that Jorge can hook it up to the RV. They get back to Jorge's house, and at some point, Mr. Cabello still stays in the truck. Mr. Garcia goes in the house, stays somewhere between 10 and 30 minutes, comes back out. At that point, somehow, he informs, or Mr. Cabello becomes aware that that Mr. Garcia is in possession of methamphetamine. Okay, so. Yeah. Did Mr. Cabello do anything knowingly to aid and abet the possession? My argument is no.
Can we back up? Yes. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to back up before we go to the possession. You're right that there's evidence that the jury heard that comes from your client's lips. What I'm trying to understand is, what does this mean? And then I told him, I was like, why the hell would you tell, like, do this to me? I just got my truck on a Saturday. I was like, I'm not trying to risk this. What would be the risk if he didn't know prior to Mr. Garcia going into the house to get the methamphetamine? What would be the risk to your client?
Well, okay, and let's suppose he knew that maybe he was going to have something, but we don't know what.
But what would be the risk? The jury heard that evidence, right? So you're here on a sufficiency of the evidence, plain error challenge. So you've got a big hurdle to get over.
And I get that. I get that.
So I'm trying to understand, what would be the risk?
Well, I mean, I think it's fair to assume that he assumed that all was not well. But under McFadden, which I attempted to argue, the words methamphetamine don't come out of anybody's mouth, or they're not induced to come out of Mr. Cabello's mouth until he says, in the truck, that's when I knew it was methamphetamine.
Assuming you're correct, and he didn't, and that's accurate, that he had no inkling until they were in the truck. Once they're in the truck, it's not the inception of the possession. He's aiding and abetting the possession, as they're driving down the car road, aren't they? That's
I want to address that, but it's going to take me a little bit if you'll humor me here.
Okay.
First of all, just to stop, to freeze frame things when they're in the truck, the word methamphetamine is apparently used, and we can say that at that point, Mr. Cabello knows his partner over here has got methamphetamine. Possession is a fait accompli. He didn't aid that.
But his continued possession.
Okay, you're right, and I'm sorry. I don't mean to be impolite.
No.
But you can't aid and abet an offense that's already been committed. Now, what happens after that, to me, is an illustration of one of the differences between conspiracy and aiding and abetting. Both offenses require that the defendant share the same criminal intent as the principal or the co-conspirator. Both offenses require participation. But the difference is, at least for purposes of this case, how much participation. This is a Supreme Court quote. A conspirator need not facilitate each and every part of the substantive offense. That's Ocasio v. United States, 136, Supreme Court, 1423. You can enter a conspiracy at any time, or a person can, so long as the conspiracy continues to be ongoing. Based on the cases that I've cited in my brief, that's not true for aiding and abetting. You have to aid and abet every element of the offense. Okay, and Judge Elrod, I'm not trying to dodge you. I'm just slow getting to your answer here. Okay, so now they're in the truck. Now at this point, if we freeze frame it, Mr. Cabello believes his partner here has methamphetamine. Does he know though what his partner's intent is? There, according to Mr. Cabello, he says, I got to go back to work. I got to go back to Fort Stockton. They get in the truck, off they go. At 10:39, there's a phone conversation. Not clear who made the call. I think the agent that testified said that Mr. Garcia called him. Now, at that point, that conversation is pretty blatant, okay? They talk about price, supposedly Mr. Garcia told him, you better be alone. I won't be alone. Don't try to rip me or whatever. Well, we can assume that at that point, Mr. Cabello knows what's up for sure on the distribution part. So, according to Mr. Cabello, they are now south of I-20, heading back to Fort Stockton. Mr. Garcia says, nope, got to go back, turn around. So they turn around, go back to the Road Ranger. Okay, I think it's fair to assume that after the phone call for sure, that and the fact that Mr. Cabello drove the truck back with Garcia in it, knowing what was going to happen, there's at least an implicit agreement between the two of them as to what's going to go on. That's a conspiracy, and I think arguably you have a conspiracy there.
What's your best case that possession is a completed offense and it's not continuing possession? The possession doesn't go on and on.
I can't. Possession in and of itself is ongoing. For the possessor.
Well, it's in his car.
Okay.
So, I mean, he could have dumped him out right there on the side of the road and said, we're not having any meth.
Well, my argument is the only point in time that he would really have felt like he needed to do that, if he was going to do it, was at the phone call. The phone call, hey, we all know what's up. I'm not doing this. We're done. But for Mr. Garcia, the offense continues all the way till he loses it. But you can't, if aiding and abetting and conspiracy both, okay, let me back up. If an aider and abetter can simply jump on the bus sometime anywhere between Mr. Garcia's possession and the time he loses it and help out a little bit, then aiding and abetting a conspiracy no longer have any difference.
Help out a little bit is aiding and abetting.
Beg your pardon?
Help out a little bit is aiding and abetting.
If you help out a little bit, every element. That's my argument.
Okay.
I
appreciate it.
Can I ask one clarifying question about your response to Judge Elrod? You agree that we're on plain error review on this claim, right?
I am. I do agree with that.
So if you don't have a case, then haven't you conceded that there is no plainness? Right. The second element is that it has to be established before this case. The second element of plain error review, that is, right? There has to be an error that's plain, that's prejudicial.
Well, I have a case. I don't think it specifically addresses the question. The case is, well, let's see if I can find it here, and then tell you what I think it says. I'll tell you what. It's United States v. Lombardi, and I cited it in the brief. The case basically stands for the proposition that aiding and abetting, if the aider and abetter does nothing to aid one of the elements, is not an aiding and abetting. It's a conspiracy. And if you make the aiding and abetting just aid anything any along the way, you have collapsed the two offenses into one. That's I think we've probably beaten that horse enough here, unless you have further questions. Okay. The other question that I intended to address was the statements in Rosamond v. United States that appear to hold that you can aid and abet only one element as opposed to all the elements. Four responses to that. I'll begin with this, just to read the language. This is from Rosamond. It is inconsequential, as courts applying both the common law and Section 2 have held, that Rosamond's acts did not advance each element of the offense. All that matters is they facilitated one component. And of course, I've cited cases in my brief. This is another one. Crime of aiding and abetting the possession of drug with intent to distribute requires proof of two elements, aiding and abetting the possession and aiding and abetting the intent to distribute. It must be proved that the defendant aided and abetted each element of the underlying offense. So how can those be reconciled? Well, if both cases use element in the same way, you can't reconcile. I can't reconcile them, but they don't. Rosamond is a 924C case, obviously. 924C, when we think of elements, we think of the forbidden conduct, the mens rea, the required result. Under the Fifth Circuit pattern jury instructions for a 924C case, you would have about five different elements. Rosamond doesn't treat that offense as if it has five elements. His acts, this is straight out of the opinion, thus advance one part, the drug part, of a two-part incident, or to speak more technically, one element, the drug element, of a two-element crime. So Rosamond doesn't use element the same way the cases I cited use it. They simply use, the element is, it's not a cluster of facts that make up an offense, it's the offense itself. That's my first response. Second one is, the Fifth Circuit has interpreted Rosamond, in this case is United States v. Bowens, 907 F3rd 347, to basically, they've said, they've quoted it and used element in the same way Rosamond used it. The evidence was sufficient to find the jury's finding on the first element, that was the gun charge. It wasn't a cluster of facts. Another case that cites it, uses it the same way, Fifth Circuit case, United States versus Jordan, 945 F3rd 245. I'd also point out that there are two Fifth Circuit cases post-Rosamond that use the same language. He must have aided and abetted each material element. One is United States v. Diaz, 941 F3rd 729. It's a healthcare fraud case. The other one is United States v. Morrison, 833 F3rd 491. It's an income tax fraud case. My last response is basically what I've already said. If aiding and abetting requires minimal participation, you don't have to aid and abet each element, you can aid and abet everything, then conspiracy and aiding and abetting have collapsed into the same offense. Further questions, I'll yield back my 33.
Counsel, I have one question about your Allen charge claim.
Beg your pardon?
I have one question about your third argument about the Allen charge.
Sure.
Do you think that that's subject to plain error review?
Oh, you got me on that one, I'm afraid. In other words, is it forfeiture or waiver?
Yes, sir.
I got one Fifth Circuit case that I found. It's unpublished. United States v. Slovacek, 500 F. Federal Appendix 360, page 362. Finally, Slovacek claims that the government erred in giving an Allen charge to the jury after it informed the judge after 3 days of deliberation that it could not reach an agreement. Before reading the charge to the jury, the district court read the charge to the defense and the government and asked if they had any objections. Because Slovacek's attorney explicitly stated that he had no objection to the modified charge, his claim is waived on appeal. It's an unpublished case. Doesn't help me, that's for sure. Thank you.
Appreciate the candor. Thank you.
Yeah, you've saved time for rebuttal, Mr. Fitzgerald. Thank you. Mr. Durbin? So I've probably asked you this sometimes in the past. So how many Fifth Circuit arguments for you, approximately?
I think this is 96.
Okay, all right. Getting up to a magic number.
I've lost track.
All right.
It's my best guess because I've... The 90s are a distant history, and all the records are gone, so I'm not quite sure, but I'm close to 100, Judge.
Okay.
When my hair reaches my knees, I'm going to quit. But anyway, it seems to me that on the aiding and abetting, the sufficiency, and the whether it's continuing an offense and that issue, what occurred to me as I thought through this, I wish I had thought of this by the time I'd written the brief, but... An analogy would be, suppose, Judge Oldham, I ran into you in the grocery store, and you walk to the grocery store, and you have purchased actually more than you planned to, and now realize you can't really carry all that home. And you come to me, and you bump into me and say, oh, do you have a car with you? Oh, yes, I do. Well, I have to do a dinner tonight, and I bought far more steaks and charcoal than I can actually carry. Can you give me a ride home? So now I know that you have charcoal and steaks. I know that you're in possession of them. You have asked me to assist you with your possession of them, to get them from the possession at the grocery store to your home where you're going to do something with them. You have an intent to do something with them, make dinner. I don't know that I particularly care that you're going to make dinner, but I'm going to assist you in that enterprise knowingly. And so, even though you had already acquired them, you'd already come into possession of the steaks and the charcoal, I'm now in the process of aiding and abetting you, facilitating, assisting you, knowingly and intentionally, to continue your possession and to get your possession to the destination where you want to do something else with those things. I think that's what we've got here. It's just, it's not steaks, it's methamphetamine. And the recording, which is Government Exhibit 5, I think makes very plain that Mr. Cabello knew there was methamphetamine when he first took Garcia to his, quote, cousin's house. He knew. And you asked the question about, well, what risk is he talking about? And he mentions risk several times in that recording. The first time is at 507. I knew like, but I didn't want to know like one like. Geez, I just got my truck, like, you know, and he said he had just gotten his truck on Saturday. He hadn't even put gas in it yet. And he says later on at 10:10, he said, and I told him, why the hell would you do this to me? I was like, whenever I just got my truck on a Saturday, I was like, I'm not going to try and risk this. And I think what he understood clearly was he could lose that truck. If he got caught in a deal delivering methamphetamine, he was going to lose the truck. It was a brand new Ford F-150 blue truck. He wouldn't let them borrow it for their own purposes. And so here he is. He's got his motive, which he claims. He has a sexual interest in Garcia. He, at some point, has a financial interest, at least insofar as he is interested in getting gas money. And he's contradictory about that, both in his statement to the police and in his testimony. But he's got motives for doing this. Basically, what he's got is, I think, a mitigation argument. He doesn't have an exoneration argument. He knew what he was doing. He knew it was meth. He knew the guy had meth. He was driving him around. He turned around and took him to the place. And that possession, I mean, I'm not quite sure what the dismissal is. Well, those were just waiver cases. I mean, those were just venue cases. Well, that's what venue is about. If it's a continuing offense, then venue properly lies wherever that offense has been convicted, committed. If it's not a continuing offense, then venue doesn't properly apply. So I don't think they're inapplicable. But I think that's what the issue boils down to. I think that the recording, it's a little difficult to hear, but and I wish we had transcribed it, because basically I sat down this week and transcribed it. And he says multiple times he knows what's going on, and he even knows the structure of the deal. It's, we're going to go make this delivery, we're going to see if it's a legitimate buyer, and then if it is, we're going to notify Jorge, and he's going to come and he's going to bring the rest of it to deliver to the buyer. And so, but the reason that I thought about the analogy of the groceries is it gets sort of confused when you're thinking about it in terms of a drug transaction, as in terms of, did he aid and abet a distribution, or did he aid and abet solely a possession with intent to distribute? Of course, the distribution never occurred.
Mr. Derby, can I ask you a question about the standard of review? I know you've seen a lot of these cases, and I'm curious how you think about this. So it's a forfeited sufficiency of the evidence argument. So those are two, that creates two different problems, right? There's the sufficiency standard, which is obviously extraordinarily high for an appellant, and then there's the plain error standard, which is obviously also very high.
Right.
And when you put them together, I'm not even sure how you go about applying them to a particular set of facts, right? Because even on a properly preserved sufficiency argument, we look for any evidence that the jury could have considered. So when you add those two, the sort of the any evidence standard for sufficiency and the fact that there couldn't possibly be, I can't imagine how you would even do plain error review on a sufficiency argument, right? Because we would be looking for something that would show the district judge that it was plainly insufficient on these facts. And I'm not sure how, I just don't even understand how you would apply the two things.
Can we just talk, and I'm not advocating right now?
Yeah, I'm just curious about the way
you... I never understood it either, Judge. It seems to me the standard for conviction is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Mm-hmm. A rational jury could find beyond a reasonable doubt. Mm-hmm. I don't know how there's anything less than that. I don't... That forfeiture doctrine that attends to Rule 29 and when you make the motion and whether or not you preserved it, I've always argued it. And I know this court has gone back and forth at times about when you're applying that, well, is it a scintilla evidence? Is it some evidence? Is it there's something in the record that supports? But as I understand the conviction, it's a constitutional standard of a rational jury could find each of the elements beyond a reasonable doubt. This is just candor. This is Richard Durbin talking, having done this for a while, not advocating for the government. But it's always sort of made me wonder, well, I think at the end of the day, we're still looking at whether or not a rational jury would find beyond a reasonable doubt. And
in this case, we don't have to resolve.
I don't think makes a difference. And you ask a good question about the Allen charge, you know, whether it's waiver or whether it's forfeiture. And you know, waiver is a knowing intentional relinquishment of the right. does the defendant have to do that? Or is it enough for his, I've got another case I'm working on right now that's got that sort of an issue where the lawyer stands up and says, well, no, we don't want a jury trial on the forfeiture aspect of it. And the defendant comes back later and says, wait a minute, nobody talked to me about this. I didn't waive it. So is it a forfeiture? Is it a waiver?
Well, we've certainly never said that Allen charges are the kind of right that the defendant must individually waive, have we?
I don't think so, no. And I mean, I look at the Allen charge, and in this particular instance, I think Judge Counts was very cautious about it. The jury had deliberated for at least 6 hours, maybe a little bit longer. They had indicated several times that didn't think they were going to be able to reach a decision. And there's nothing wrong, no complaints about the language of the charge. And it's a well-balanced charge, and it seems to me on this case it was well-timed, it was well-given, and you never know what's going on with a jury. You know, we sort of look at them as this single mind that comes back with this wise judgment, but who knows what's going on back in there? And maybe all that they needed at that point was, look, guys, if you don't do this, somebody else is going to have to do it. That's not coercive. That's just, oh, okay, yeah, okay, well, then we'll step up and do it, and that's all there is to it. But, and we don't know, but I don't think you can look at the circumstances of how long it took them to come back after the charge and say, oh, well, that was coercive, because we don't know how often they come back after a charge and find not guilty or don't come back within, you know, 10 or 15 minutes. So I just don't think that that's particularly, I mean, it's in all the cases, but I don't think it's a particularly informative indicator. I'm just sort of guessing at it. I don't have anything else to add to Rosemond. I don't really understand it. I think, Judge Elrod, you wrote the opinion in a case called Cooper that involved a 924C, and it was a gun in a backpack, and it was a plain error standard of review, and the defendant knew about the backpack, and he knew it was a drug deal, and the gun was in there, and under plain error review, that, I think, is, the court said that's sufficient. But that's not this case. I don't know which elements we're talking about that he didn't aid and abet, because the allegation was he aided and abetted the possession with intent to distribute methamphetamine. Well, he associated himself with it. He participated in it. He acted in such manner to bring about the object of it. I don't think this is a question of, oh, well, it's a conspiracy, but not aiding and abetting. He assisted. He knew what he was doing. He may not have been a professional dope dealer or an experienced one, but he knew what he was up to, and as you point out with the comments about risk to the truck, he knew well enough to know what he was exposing himself to, and it wasn't just being arrested. He was going to lose his truck, which clearly meant a lot to him. But if there are no other questions, I'll give my time.
Thank you, Mr. Durbin. Mr. Cuchero, you've saved some time for rebuttal.
Well, I did transcribe as best I could the interview, and I'll agree with Mr. Durbin, it was difficult to do, but I think based on Judge Oldham's question about why would you do this to me, I think it's important to notice the sequence here, at least as I wrote down. This begins at 10:13 during the interview, and this is after Deputy Ornelas has kind of put the clamps down on Mr. Cabello and said, look, let's tell me the truth here. Okay, whenever we were at that house, that's when he told me he was going to take something. Question. You knew what it was. You knew what it was. Answer. And I told him, why would you do this to me? I just got my truck on Saturday. Why the hell would you do this to me? Okay, question. Now, here's the deal. When you left his house, you knew what was in it, right? You knew there was meth. Answer. Yeah. Okay, so it looks to me like the question or his comment, why would you do this to me, occurred right after he knows now for sure that this is meth, not sometime before, and I may have misunderstood your question. I have looked up a number of aiding possession cases. I'm not going to go through all of them. I can't find any of them where merely driving a truck or driving a vehicle with somebody in it constitutes aiding and abetting. And I know the court knows this, but these are quotes from Fifth Circuit cases. Proof of mere negative acquiescence will not suffice. Proof that a defendant associated with a person who controls the drug is insufficient to prove constructive possession. The defendant must share the intent to commit the offense. Again, this is a pretty reluctant guy here. And, you know, I don't know what intent in conspiracy is compared to intent for aiding and abetting, but this is a reluctant guy. The aiding and possession cases that I find, this is U.S. versus Aguirre, 716 F. 2nd, 293. A reasonable jury could infer that Aguirre supplied the drugs to Cervantes. Cervantes is the defendant. If you supply the drugs, you certainly aided possession. This is United States v. Fishel, 686 F. 2nd, 1082. This was quoted in both government's brief and my reply brief. Fishel shared control over the disposition of the cocaine when in the hotel room with Ludwig suffices to prove assistance to Ludwig in possession of the cocaine. The last one, I'm going to skip one here just because this was United States v. Pozo, 697 F. 2nd, 1238. And evidence that Pozo's helped arrange the sale, that says without more, would not suffice.
Well, I think the government takes the position that the official case is the one that controls here, right?
Correct. Well, I mean, that's the one they cited. But my point is that going back to Mr. Durbin's example, he knows that the guy has charcoal, but that's not enough. He's already possessed it. And the fact that it's an ongoing crime for that guy doesn't make it an ongoing crime for the aider and abettor. I guess that's my argument. And I know I've beaten that for a long time. That's all I got. Anything else?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Cachero. And the court notices that you're court appointed, and we want you to know how much we appreciate your willingness to take the appointment. It's not easy to pursue a plain error case, and you've done a fine job, and we hope you'll be continually available to take appointments in the court.
I will. Thank you.
Your case is under submission.